You're listening to Radio Aryan at RadioAryan.com.
Hello, and welcome back to Truthful Out Radio. Today's date is Friday, the 14th of July, 2017, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks. Before I bring on my co-host, I'd better talk a little bit about what's been going on at Radio Aryan recently. I do apologise for last week. We just had empty air. I had a bit of a medical condition that required urgent attention. I am feeling better now. I am recovering now, but it is something that's probably going to end up costing me a lot of money over future years. So if people do want to help out with my health at all, I will probably put some of that that we get in donations for Radio Aryan towards that, because at the moment I fund Radio Aryan out of my pocket. So if you would like to help, please do. There's a Bitcoin wallet that's on the Radio Aryan site. It's not something that the NHS are going to pay for. I've got to pay for it out of my pocket, and it is necessary, as you know. I wasn't here all of last week, and thank you very much to all the people that sent me messages and Twitter and emails that were concerned about what was going on, because, you know, I wouldn't leave the radio without any content on there. As you know, if I go away anywhere, I will always provide enough content for the following week when I'm not here. So people were right to be worried, and things are much better now. We know what the problem is, we know what the solution is, and I am getting better. And obviously, we've got a podcast for you today. Next week, I'm hoping to have Jez Turner with me on Monday, because Subal wants a bit of time off. And the Daily Traditionalist is going to have to become a bit of an occasional traditionalist. Part of the reason for this problem was overworking, really. Just doing too much. People don't realize the amount of time it takes to find 6 hours worth of content for the listeners every day. And I do love doing what I'm doing. Don't get me wrong. I love doing it. But I've got to try and take a step back a little bit and think about my health. So we'll be having the occasional traditionalist. And on the days when we don't have one of them, we'll have Aryan narrations for you. So there'll still be plenty of content. It's just we won't be doing so much live stuff. But of course, we will be continuing with Truthful Out Radio, of course. And that brings me to my co-host, the producer of Adolf Hitler, The Greatest Story Never Told, Mr. Dennis Wise, who's here joining me tonight. Dennis, how you doing?
A lot better than you, I think. Good to hear your voice again.
It's good to be back. It's good to be back. Yeah, I noticed these lines aren't bouncing very much on my little software strip here. Let me just check in the chat room that people can hear me okay. It looks very, very strange here. You can hear me okay, Dennis, can you?
Sounds a bell.
Well, it must be recording okay then. Yeah, since we haven't been here, you've brought out two episodes of the new series, part 4 and part 5, which I just watched again. Part 4 we talked a little bit about, I think, before. It included that nun with a really powerful speech at the end about Roman Catholicism, and part 5, all about the Spanish Civil War, something which I really didn't know much about until I saw that that episode. Where should we start? Should we start with the Spanish Civil War, since we covered part 4 in the last episode, I think?
Hang on, well, won't be awkward. Yeah, got it. All right.
Well, no, we could go back to the nun if you want. She was very, very powerful.
Yeah. But it's something that I don't think many people know of or about. I certainly not taught in, I believe, in American schools. It certainly weren't taught in when I were at school. And when you get to see the actual video and the gist of the story, you can probably understand why.
Well, yeah, I wasn't aware that King Ferdinand had done something to the banks. That's what you start off with, isn't it? You mentioned that in the 19th century, he got rid of the bankers. And I looked up on Wikipedia about King Ferdinand, and I couldn't find any mention of that. I could find that the establishment were against him. The whole Wikipedia page is saying, oh, how terrible he was. And then it tells you that the public were actually very supportive of him. So he was obviously terrible to the upper classes, but not not the workers so much. So where did you find that information out, and what was it he did to the bankers?
Well, actually, it was from an educated woman, can't remember her name at the moment, who sent a letter to a person explaining what you need to understand before you actually understand the 1936 revolution. And she wrote so eloquently and so intelligently that, you know, and she said right at the end that the Catholic Church and Spain, since that time, you know, anything said about him is all detrimental. You know, they don't actually come out and tell you the real story. So consequently, this is where it originally came from. And when I read that, and then I looked it up and I saw certain things which didn't actually say it like you said, but certainly pointed in that direction. And like I said, I have no doubt, because Europe at that time, all across Europe, there was a war going on for thousands of years to keep usury out. So this is nothing new. And it's just the fact that 8 years later, they actually caused a revolution there.
Yeah, so you're saying that you heard this from a woman. That was, you know, that was the first bit that I heard. What was that, from YouTube?
No. This was I can't remember what website it were, but they'd done something on the Spanish Civil War, and there were people commenting on it. And then this woman wrote this letter, which was, I found so educated and such a class letter that this woman wrote, that it caught my eye, obviously. And she explained, you've got to understand these things about the 1820 revolution before you can even talk about the Spanish one in 1936. But she also warned that, you know, you won't find much out about this, because since that time, the Catholic Church and Spain have been demonized by, you know, the obvious people. And so consequently, I did go on to have a look, and I saw things that led me to believe her, knowing the fact that Europe had been fighting for a few hundred years more to keep usury out, because this is the way the Jews take over countries. You know, the financial, trap them in debt, and this is exactly what they were trying to do with Spain.
Yeah, so he stood up against that.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously they then tried to get their own back against him. I mean, what I was looking at on Wikipedia, it seemed that Napoleon was involved, and he got rid of this king, and he locked this king away, and eventually he was forced to free the king, and they were trying to force him to go along with some liberal constitution. I suspect that the liberal constitution made it possible for the bankers to go along with their usurious plans, and that's what he was standing against.
Yeah.
And then you well, go on.
I was just going to say about Napoleon, I mean, he was one of the heads, you know, winners from the French Revolution. He was a Freemason, and he freed up all the Jews in Europe, in all the ghettos in Europe. He was a big friend to the Jews. Now, I've heard people say different, but I haven't found anything different to what I've just said, which I'm a little bit gutty over, because I always liked Napoleon, because he was obviously a brilliant general. But actually, what he actually was kind of run a battle with the Catholic Church and the Pope. Actually, I can't remember the word now. What's the word when they get rid of them? Well, they don't get rid of them; they ban them. But yeah, he was a friend of the Jew. And obviously, they must have turned them at the end, I would think.
Yeah, and Napoleon ended up emancipating the Jews, didn't he? He ended up freeing them and making them citizens along with everyone else. And that was pretty much the downfall of white civilization from then onwards, really, because the Jews were able to become politicians. They were able to own things that they weren't allowed to own before. They were able to take over the factories, take everything over once they were put on an equal footing with white people, with Europeans. So Napoleon, he's not one of the good guys, I don't think.
No.
Didn't he blow off the face of the Sphinx as well, or something like that?
Well, actually, I think he tried to invade, to take Palestine for the Jews, but he was beaten back. I think the only reason I can think of him trying to get Palestine is because of this so-called legacy of the Jews going back to the Promised Land. But fortunately, we're beaten back. And like you said, they don't give up. I mean, like, you know, this king did what he did and stopped him for 8 years, but they'll always come back again. And same with Russia. You know, the Rothschilds don't forgive and they don't forget.
Yeah, they certainly don't. That seems to be the proud motto of the Jews today anyway, after the Holocaust.
Yeah. Yeah, that's obviously the more they push that works in their favour for certain agendas. The point being is that this was a nice way, a slightly different way of producing this next episode, because obviously I had the Spanish music as well, which I come across, which I loved. And so with that, we started a real Spanish atmosphere to the actual video.
I think then you jump forwards to the actual attacks starting, the Bolsheviks being moved over there and Russia's financing, or the Soviet Union's financing of these troops over there so that they could take Spain down. And that reminded me of exactly what goes on today with Soros. And he has the Otpor, this Otpor revolution that took place in Serbia. And they had like a university or a training camp. And basically all these revolutionaries were trained there. And then they were sent out to the Ukraine for the first color revolution there. They were sent out to Georgia to start a revolution there. And even sent out to Egypt to start off the Arab Spring. Yeah. All these people that were involved, these supposedly grassroots uprising that happened in these countries, a lot of the journalists and the people involved had all been trained at this Otpor Academy in Serbia, which was run by Soros the Jew, and obviously with his links to communism and the Soviet idea. And it's this same thing was going on back then at the turn of the century, 20th century rather, with the overthrow of the Tsar. And once the communists took power there, they were obviously training up troops and then sending them off into other countries, like sending them off into Germany and sending them off into Spain. I think you tracked some of the money as well that was for funding this.
Certainly did, yeah. But it's true what you're saying, because they have a system and they've been using the same system for a long time. And that includes the crashing of banks where they, you know, I mean, it's all tried and tested. What they do is, you know, they'll make things good for a country and everybody's happy and everybody's going out buying their holidays, buying the cars and everything. Then they'll crash that economy. And then suddenly it's payback time. We want our money, can't afford it, take off their house, take off the car, whatever. They've always done it. And this is a system, just like infiltrations into other countries like Syria. You know, you compare that quite easily to Spain. You know, they've always done this kind of thing. But what they've also done is covered up, because when they've got the media and other means of learning these things, education system, publishing, when they've tied all that up, you're not going to hear about these revolutions. And this is one reason, I think, why we haven't heard about the Spanish one.
Yeah, I've heard that brave people from Scotland and England went over there to fight against the nasty king on the side of the communists. But you haven't heard much about the atrocities that were carried out by these communists. I think there was a famous author, George Orwell, that went over there fighting on the side of the communists. And he pointed out that Scotland was actually the country that sent the most people over there. But we hear about that now as if we're proud that we sent people over there to act as mercenaries, basically, to fight against the nationalists on the side of the communists. And it's a similar thing to when they were encouraging Muslims to go over and fight in Syria a couple of years back.
Because they all come over here, they live over here, and then the war's back home and they all go back, which is no different, just the colour.
Well, it's like meddling in other countries, isn't it, really? You got Stalin that's meddling in Spain and sending these troops in, and then you've got Scots that are volunteering to go over there and meddling over there. And it wasn't until Franco really sort of rose up and took power and then invited Hitler in, that they were able to stop all this fighting. I think you made a point as well that it started a couple of years before the war, didn't it, the World War?
Yeah, well, the financials thing was actually about, I think, 1931, and then through to right up to 36, there were certain things going on, like more money and training, getting ready for it. Interestingly enough is, if you can remember in one of the early episodes where I said that it's obvious now, with Schiff taking 600 million pounds worth of rupees in gold out of the Soviet Union, you know, the bankers own Soviet Union. There's only, you know, Stalin and Lenin, really what they are just their own wages, good wages, but, you know, the leaders of the country, but the fronting. The real owners after the Bolshevik Revolution was the international bankers. And this now does throw a whole new light on things, because we've always thought as Russia and America as two separate entities, when they weren't. They were both ruled by the bankers because they controlled the finances. So consequently, when it comes to this, the bankers can sit in the background now and let Stalin take all the limelight. And this is why, you know, it's so difficult to track them down. But the fact is, it was Stalin who was training people. It was Stalin who was giving the money, but all with the bankers' blessings, because they own the factory.
Yeah, they're the ones that are funding it. He's the puppet that's dancing to their tune. And I guess there will always be people that want to do that. There will always be people that want to sell out and do whatever they can for the banks, sell their own people out.
There'll be a queue somewhere, I'm sure.
Well, yeah, government's fuller than today, isn't it, with the EU? Yeah. All
Blair
the time.
And all them. I mean, I'm quite sure they knew the score after a certain point and they had a decision to make. Well, I'd say another thing, what was interesting to me, little things that stood out, which I hadn't really thought about before, was how they banned the European salute. You know, what people call the Nazi salute, the straight arm with the hand raised out, how they banned that. And yet, the clenched fist of the communists is never going to be banned, is it?
And that clenched fist is even used by that OTPOR organisation, Soros organisation. Their symbol was a clenched fist. I think the feminists use it as well.
I think they do. It's a typical communist across-the-board type of thing. Whereas the Nazi salute, they call it a Nazi salute, is really a European nationalist salute, which goes back to Roman days.
Yeah, it's a Roman salute. I mean, there's a famous painting of people all doing that. I forget what it's called. I think that's about 500 years old. But that goes, you know, that's a custom and a tradition that goes way back. It's really bizarre. It looks like the software's just fixed itself. 20 minutes
magic.
In.
Magic.
Yeah. I'm going to have to do some work on that. I do apologise, Dan. It's been very hard for me to concentrate on what you're saying and also try and get this fixed up and working as well. It's sort of straight in at the deep end after 2 weeks off trying to do three or four.
Sometimes it's best way to be.
Different things at once. Yeah, I'm trying to recall some other bits from the Spanish video. Refresh my mind on what happens next.
Well, I can go through it quite easily. I mean, obviously, I kind of show people that it's being financed by the bankers and sourced as well. And then we actually go into the actual expectations of this Spanish Revolution. What's really confusing to a lot of people is how they've all mixed up the Republican side, because the Republican side is really just out communists. But they kind of use, you know, the Republicans or the anarchists or the liberals or this, or somebody who's not really clued up politically can be a bit, you know, confused by it all. So, and if I ever watch any of these documentaries on YouTube, very rarely do they use the word communism. And I'll leave a comment saying I wish someone would just get straight to the point, because if them people in Scotland knew and the people in the Lincoln Brigade knew in America, I'm quite sure the people who were organising these documentaries knew.
Well, you wouldn't think it, would you? You wouldn't think that Republican actually meant communist. And back then, you wouldn't think liberal meant communist. It was all the same thing. These revolutions were all being masterminded by the Freemasons from the French Revolution onwards. And they're all just claiming to be championing different rites and different people, but they all achieved the same things. They were all about taking down the monarchy and then saying that we're going to be putting the people in charge. And then what you really had put in charge were these stooges of the bank. So, and whereas before you had the monarchy that had to obey the Christian law, otherwise the church would be on their backs.
You're spot on here.
So they had a rule book that they had to obey, and they had to stand up for the people. And yet the people got convinced that it would be a good idea to get rid of the monarchy and put the bankers' secretaries in charge, basically. It's a con. It's always been this con that illusion. Somebody else has got it better than you, and they don't deserve it, and you should take it from them, rather than, you know, you should try to be happy with your lot and make the best that you possibly can out of what you've got, and do what you can for yourself, not get jealous of what other people have. And I think
this is fair play. I mean, I think it was E. Michael Jones I was listening to the other day, and he mentioned the French Revolution, and he said how people said that the Illuminati had instigated and done the revolution. But he went with a good point, actually. He said they couldn't have done it on their own. Impossible. And he went back to the Freemason Hall in London, the main one in England, and he said Freemason was exported out into Europe to take down the Catholic governments and monarchs, which is identical to what you just said. So, you know.
Now, when you think about it, it's very clever, really, because you think it's Freemasons and it's bankers that are behind it. And that's the upper classes, that's the noble class. And yet the people that they use for their revolutions are the working class and the peasants. So somehow they managed to convince the peasants and the working class to fight on their side.
Well, they do it with countries as well, don't they? I mean, they've managed to get America to fight their wars for them. You've had Britain fighting their wars from them. They were very devious and very clever. I'm often getting in research into these things, and I'm thinking this is some web this spider's woven, because it really is difficult to spot straight away. You've really got to, you know, dig deep and be alert as well at the same time.
Well, I think
interesting. Sorry, go on.
I was going to say, I think it goes back to something that we've discussed before about how people don't want to believe that other people can be as wicked and as evil as to be pedophiles and Satanists. And the same thing, people don't want to believe that the people leading the revolution have got their worst interests at heart. It's the same as today. People don't want to believe that these politicians really hate them. I mean, the people that support the Conservative Party and support the Labour Party, they believe that these politicians have got their best interests at heart. But they haven't. Time and time again, you see that they haven't. But people just still seem to believe it. So the people, you know, some of them must have believed that Stalin and Lenin were doing the right thing. And these ones that were fighting against Franco must have thought that.
I mean, people, I think you've hit the nail on the head, really, when you said, you know, they play on people's, you know, they say, look, you know, this isn't right. They've got all this wealth. I think, you know, you deserve a bit as well. And it plays on people especially when they're having a hard time. So, you know, you'll have people from Scotland going over there fighting, believing that communism is the way to go in the world without realizing the real thing behind the curtain. But what's interesting here is that, I mean, Franco to me was not that known of a figure, and so I learned a lot myself out of it. And I mean, being a general at 33 is quite remarkable. You know what I mean? I mean, that's not an old age to be a general. Usually a lot older than that. So, you know, obviously a natural soldier, and so obviously I introduced him early in the part, showing just exactly that there had been this young, vibrant general out there in Africa, and was rewarded with being obviously being made a general. But at the time, I mean, I've been trying to say this to a lot of people, that, you know, Christianity, if you don't understand that about World War II, then you're never going to get it. And this Spanish Civil War epitomizes, shall I say, World War II, where you had this battle of Christianity against the atheist, communists, the Jews, and that just carried on 6 months later with World War II. But jumping ahead a bit here, like, well, Franco takes over, But his troops, I always knew this, his troops were stranded in Africa. Now, it doesn't say this in the documentary, but this is what I was led to believe. And he asked Hitler for help. And obviously, I've been an advocate of Hitler being the protector of Christianity in Europe. And as the documentary shows, didn't hesitate. 2 days, not only did he send him the arms he wanted, but he sent the Air Force over to get his army back into Spain. Now, people don't realize at this point, Madrid had been taken over by the communists, and the clergy were being slaughtered. There were more slaughtered in them early days than any point. And so the fact that Hitler managed to get those troops back into Spain so they could fight their way to Madrid and to Barcelona, you know, without Hitler, Franco knew, you know, he had a real problem.
And Hitler did the right thing there as well. I think instead of sending the German troops in, he helped to bring over all the Spanish ones that were over there in North Africa to help out. But yeah, just what you were saying there about Franco and him being a general at 33, this just goes to prove, doesn't it, that in times of trouble, someone will step forward. Nature will provide somebody with that special something that can rise to the top. And if the people support him and they can see that it's the right man for the job, then he'll get things done. The same as happened with Hitler. So we may not have good kings anymore. We may not have the bloodlines anymore. They've all got corrupted. But somebody will eventually arise from among the masses of the people. And it's just a question of spotting them.
Well, it's funny you say that, because I can remember reading once about the British Empire. They were keeping an eye on some place, and they said that they were expecting somebody with some charisma and leadership qualities. So they know that that's possible as well. So they look out for it as well. But certainly in this case, that person was Franco. He was obviously dedicated to what he was trying to do. And like I said, he managed eventually. I mean, people, if you go on YouTube or the internet, you'll see people whinging about the bombing of Barcelona. But David Irving came out with a fair point. He was listening to us at one point, and he said after a particular day's bombing, the communist newspaper went out and did a survey about how many people had died. And there's something like 29 people had died in this day's bombing. And like David Irving said, they never did a survey on Dresden, did they?
They'll always only highlight the way things that they can put into a bad light. I mean, we see that recently, contrasting Mosul with Aleppo. They won't tell you about all the civilian casualties that in Mosul. They'll tell you all about it in Aleppo. It's fine for them to bomb, you know, the extremist Muslim-controlled areas in Iraq. But if you suggest they get rid of the extremist Muslims in the Muslim-controlled areas in Britain, they'll lock you up for hate speech. This is one thing I really don't understand.
It's true. That struck me as well. Because obviously, you know, watch a bit of Sky News every now and again, like, and it's as biased as it comes with Murdoch being in charge. But yeah, you're right. But at least, like I said, people don't really want to know about a civil war, because it tells you then that there's a Christianity link, because not only does Hitler come to the rescue, being a Catholic, but Mussolini comes with some troops, and he's a Catholic. So suddenly you've got three nationalist Catholic leaders in a fight against communism. And now it doesn't take a genius to start working things out.
Are you going to be doing an episode on Mussolini at all, do you think?
I've actually thought about it because, you know, again, he's a bit of a mystery to me as well, apart from what I've heard of Hitler, who did really like the guy, obviously sent his lads out to rescue him at one point. So I think it's quite possible. I will be looking into that. I think people would like that.
Didn't he say that he was actually in power for 17 years before the war started?
Yeah, about 1920, I think. We're in it, something like 22, something like that. So he was well liked, you know, a lot of propaganda against him as well. And the bestial ending that him and his girlfriend faced, I mean, I've touched on that in The Greatest Story Never Told, where they've got forensic evidence now to say that his clothes have been removed, her clothes have been removed, she'd been raped, and he'd been sodomized. So, you know, that's because we had a question that these communists had him for 24 hours when the partisans first caught him.
If he was in power for 17 years, he must have had masses of public support, the same as Adolf Hitler had masses of public support. Yeah. You look at Putin, he's got an 80, 90% approval rating, and yet the media makes him out to be a dictator and a monster. Look at Assad, he's got a 90% approval rating. I mean, these politicians that have actually been in power for decades, that are loved by their people, the establishment hates them. The Western establishment hates them with a vengeance for actually doing the right thing by their people. Not being voted out after 5 years because the people actually love them. The average Brit looks at that and thinks when they're waving pictures of them, oh, look how ridiculous they are. They must have been told to say how much they love their leader. No, it's genuine.
It's always been a mystery to me. They can't see it. Some can, I think, these days, but not enough, really.
That's what you would do, isn't it? If you had a politician in charge that had given you housing, that had given you a job, that had got rid of usury in the banks. You would want to go out there waving a picture of his face and waving a flag and cheering him. These tears you see rolling down their faces, they're genuine. The looks of joy you see on the faces of the people looking at Adolf Hitler, the looks of joy on the faces of people looking at Gaddafi, the people cheering Putin on. I mean, it's genuine. It's absolutely genuine. And I think more and more people are waking up to this because the mainstream media, I mean, its day is done. It really is. Its day is done. Yeah, people are waking up to these lies that they're telling about these other politicians. We can see that our ones are such lies.
I think once the crack started, with Trump, I think that's when the cracks started. People really started to see that the media were manipulous, devious. I think then that once them cracks appear, then it's not long for the old to start appearing. And I think that's what's happening.
Well, you could just see that today. I mean, he's been meeting Macron and Macron's wife, and he said to Macron's wife, "Cool, you look really well. You're looking after yourself well." A very nice thing to say. You look after yourself well. That's a compliment. And yet the BBC have been saying, "Oh, what a slimy thing to say! What a backhanded compliment!" He was insulting Macron's wife.
The old Freemasons at the BBC,
even when somebody pays someone a compliment, they have to turn it around and say that it's the opposite, and that it's an insult. I don't think people.
It's never ending, isn't it? It's constantly trying to demonise certain people. I mean, don't get me wrong. Trump's not my favourite person at the moment, but I'm using that example of his media, of what the media had against him, is just exactly the same tactics what go against these nationalistic leaders. And I remembered this video from a few years back about the Scots going to Spain to fight. And so I dug it up on YouTube and I edited it down. And this shows that the Scots were socialist communists and went out there. They've always been a violent breed. But Scotland is a country which never kicked out the Jews. The Jews have always been at home in Scotland. And eventually they moved down to England and took over England as well. So Scotland really, has a lot to answer for in many ways. But certainly when they went over there, they got the shock of the lies because the first day they were over there, a lot of them, first battle at least, a lot of them got killed.
It did actually make me laugh when I saw that, Dennis. I thought, oh, yeah, that's where the Scots got it from, is it? Looking at that SNP.
Yeah, because Aberdeen apparently is one of the most socialistic places in Great Britain, I believe. Any politician who goes up there who's not a socialist is roasted alive.
Very leftist. They had the Templars went there as well, didn't they? When the Templars were kicked out from France, they ended up all going over to Scotland, and you've got a lot of masonry there. You got the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry. You've got Roslyn Chapel there, which is the centre of Freemasonry, and the Templars. Sinclair is supposed to have built that just after Jacques de Molay was burnt alive. Apparently a fleet of ships full of Templars made their way over to Scotland. So maybe that plays into it as well.
That's true. And I mean, they got involved with the Brave Art War. I think they helped Robert the Bruce to beat the English that battle at the end of the film, believe it or not.
Yeah, have you dug up any more about that? About these communists in Scotland, or just
just what I more or less said, that they have this. There's some kind of a base in Scotland. I know I had a friend from Glasgow a few years ago, died a while back, and we didn't talk politics much. But whenever he did, and I mentioned communism, he just said to me, nothing wrong with communism. He'd come from Glasgow. And I'm thinking, does this guy really know what communism means? I'm pretty sure he didn't. You know what I mean? I mean, good guy, working class guy, but I'm not convinced he knew the ins and outs of it all. And I think that goes for a lot in Scotland. It's probably a family thing where they've been, you know, told. And we saw the amount that went out there, equivalent to the rest of the volunteers. 40,000 went out there from all over the world, but 500 went out from Scotland, which proportionally was supposed to have been the more. In fact, I found some more information, actually, that MI5 thought only 2,500 had left the British Isles to fight in Spain, where it's actually double that. It's nearly 5,000 went, according to one of the newspapers. Can't remember which one there.
What about Ireland? Is there many that went over there from Ireland? Yeah, know the IRA are very Marxist, weren't they?
Well, they are Marxist, yeah, but you've got to remember Ireland is a Catholic country. Spain is a Catholic country. Germany, you know, Italy. There was a whole bunch of them from Ireland, Catholics, went out to fight with Franco.
Ah, so it was the other way around.
They got harassed when they got back as well at the customs. Had to take the uniforms off, all the usual stuff, you know.
Well, if Ireland was a Catholic country, why did they end up being the Republic of Ireland? Because they're like proud Republicans now, aren't they?
Well, you know, I touched on that point at one point before where, you know, I saw a photograph of Prince Charles and one of the IRA leaders touching foreheads, more or less. They were that close. And yet it wasn't that long back that they were supposed to be, you know, hated each other's guts, so to speak. And that always made me wonder whether or not this war in Ireland was a false flag. I don't know. It certainly meant, you know, I mean, at the end of the day, Ireland hasn't got its independence. These politicians who led the IRA are all getting good money now and living the high life. And Britain and England haven't lost anything at all.
Yeah, I think in Ireland, they used to have the High Kings of Tara there. And they had the Stone of Scone. They were very proud of their royal family. I wonder what actually happened to them.
Well, the Marxists, like you say, get the IRA. And that's never good because, obviously, when you're Marxist, and especially if you're in league with the Jews, then the Irish people themselves will suffer at some stage.
And their constitution that they got in 1916 or whatever, I mean, it talks about the proud heritage of the Irish people. And then it pretty much says that anyone that sets foot on Irish soil can call themselves Irish and become an Irish citizen. So it ended up being one of the first sort of, we'll welcome anyone from around the world and they can call themselves Irish, which has obviously led to, you know, Dublin
mass immigration,
not being Irish anymore. There's a really good political party over there that I've mentioned before called the Nationalist Party, or the National Party. And I think Justin Barrett, I think, is the guy's name behind it. And he when you hear him talking, it's National Socialist. All the policies that they have are National Socialist policies. And I really hope that Ireland manages to galvanise behind this National Party. They get a lot of views on YouTube, and I don't have much contact with people from actually over there, but they do seem like a good party, and I'd never heard of them before. I just thought I'd give them a mention. I'd try and advertise them a bit if I could, because they're a proper white nationalist party, and the guy's got charisma, because Ireland's had a really bad time of it, really. And as you say, part of the EU, and even when they vote to not be a part of it, they're told they've got to vote again twice. Now they've got legalised gay marriage. They've got a homosexual Pakistani as the president. I mean, think Britain's going right, down. Is it? Look at Ireland.
It's got the J word all over it, hasn't it?
Yeah, these fake nationalist parties, like the Scottish Nationalist Party, and the Sinn Féin is supposed to be speaking up for the Irish, and they're just Marxists. They're all internationalists. It's all a cover. And the only genuine nationalist parties that ever actually got anywhere were these ones in the 30s and the 40s that we're talking about here.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they're always Christian as well. This is the thing. If when they were Christian, they got somewhere. If they're not going to claim to uphold Christian values and they're not going to support Christianity, I don't think they have a hope of getting anywhere.
Well, the thing is, with the Spanish Revolution and the Scots, there's also that religion side to it, which comes from Ireland. A lot of Rangers, I'll guarantee a lot of these Scottish fans were Rangers fans. Because there's a Catholic Protestant kind of rivalry, and the ones in Ireland, no doubt would have been Celtic fans because back then, that's what it was, Catholics against Protestants. So that would have come into it at some stage as well. But that surprised me when the commentator said that they were asked to leave because they felt if they left, all these volunteers, that Hitler and Mussolini pulled their troops out weapons out, which I don't know where they got that idea from.
Well, they were proper armies that were in there. I mean, these Scots that were there, they were just a group of Scots that had gone over there to fight. Yeah. And, obviously, Hitler and Mussolini had troops in there.
That's right.
Helping out. And Spain was really helpful after the war. Spain is the one that actually, only one that managed to keep its legitimate government after the war. How did that happen, Dennis? How did that happen? How did they get to keep their legitimate government when all the others lost theirs?
Well, this is interesting, this, because if you look at the map of Europe, and I haven't got one in front of me, but if you can imagine the map of Europe, if you notice in the documentary, Britain actually signed some kind of treaty to say they would not get involved with it and there would not be arms, be sent to Spain. France also signed that agreement, but this is without people's knowledge that they would have known that Spain was going to be financed anyway and Stalin would play a big part in it. They would have known that. It's obvious to me now. So consequently, if you look at the map of Europe where France is, France has Spain behind it and then it's got Germany and Italy in front of it. So France would have been surrounded by nationalistic fascist national socialists. And yet they didn't enter that war and neither did Britain. And it's like I said, the reason why was if they were shown to be fighting on the side of the communists, that's going to blow a lot of cover up. And same with Roosevelt as well, because they held back as well. So it's a civil war. They don't get involved with civil wars. Let's wait for the real war, which was only 6 months after the Spanish War. So that is why I believe that happened. Now, Franco, when the war kicked off 6 months after the Spanish War finished, there was no fit state. That was... Maybe the documentary is not even vicious enough, but that was a vicious civil war. A lot of people died, over between 500,000 and 1,000,000 people died. So there was no fit state to go and fight in another war, which consequently Spain never actually managed to get officially in the war, but did send, as I mentioned, volunteers, especially for the Russian campaign, which again ties up to what happened in Spain. So consequently, when the war finished, the only safe haven in all of Europe was Spain, because this mass persecution now, communist persecution, under the guise of the Holocaust and all this, we're out to wipe out every single national socialist going. And people like Leon de Grelle, people like Otto Scorsese, they all found safe haven in Spain, and a lot went through Spain out of Europe because they weren't sure how long Spain had held up, I suppose, and they went to South America. So, but he stayed, and I think he ruled for about 40 years, something like that. He kept Spain in peace, and he also had the crime down. The execution method of the garrote, which it's like a nut and bolt around your neck, and they squeeze it till you're strangled. It's not a nice particular way to go, but it obviously worked because murders were hardly, any crime at all. Was early apparent in them days. As soon as that, Franco died and things changed, obviously it become a socialist paradise. Drugs, murders, whatever you name it, it's gone back to how, you know, Berlin would have been in the 30s. So, but he had to appease then. Obviously, there'll be a lot of people not happy with him after the war because he is harbouring these SS soldiers and generals, etc. So there would have been some people after him. And I did find some photograph of him shaking hands with, Eisenhower at one point. But he would have had to because, obviously, you know, Spain would have been standing on its own then against the rest of the world. So he did remarkably well, I thought, to last as long as he did and eventually die, if you get my point.
Yeah, so Spain didn't lose their legitimate government because Spain didn't actually take part in the war.
Officially, that's right.
Officially. So then you've got 40 years after that. How did Spain then become socialist so quickly after he died? Surely he must have had somebody there to take his place.
I think this is what happened. I'm not 100%. I'm 99% sure. What he did, when he was dying, he named a successor, and that wasn't the older king; it was the younger one. Apparently, he was at the funeral, but he died young, and I believe it was his wife, who, with the Bilderbergers and all this kind of carry on, got involved, and that's how Spain turned. I think it was the king's wife after her husband had died.
So it was to do with the king then, rather than...
Yeah. So Franco died, didn't
he? Yeah, was Franco appointed by the king?
Franco appointed himself once he won the war. I would do, to be honest.
Well, it was the right thing, obviously.
Well, he's doing the right thing. This guy's talking about it later, and he says, there were nobody brave enough to take him on after that war. And he did purge the communists. Just like the communists purged the National Socialists after World War II, you're talking of wars of ideology, and they're always going to come back, you see. So he did a white purge, a white terror, on the communists, which of course part of which was building the monument where he was eventually buried, and all the people on his side are buried who were killed in that war as well. So one thing about the communists, they're good builders because it looked good.
What was his ideology then? Was he fascist? Was he national socialist? Was he just nationalist? What makes him stand out from the rest?
Well, I think if you talk to some fascists, they'll think that he let them down because the fascist leader died and Franco said certain things so that he could get them to follow him, which is not the bad thing to do, because if you're going to go into a war, you want to be as unified as you possibly can. But if you were going to nail me down to what he was, I believe he was a nationalist and a Christian, probably a Christian first. And he believed that this was a war, as if you can remember that speech of Hitler's in The Greatest Story Ever Told right at the very end, when he said, "This isn't just a war for Europe, this is a war for mankind." He believed that this was a war for civilization for Christianity against pagans and Jews and all the rest of them. And that, I think, is what drove him.
Well, what was he like against the Jews then? Did he speak out against the Jews, or did he speak out against bankers and internationalists? Well, did he name the Jew?
Put it this way. If he did, we wouldn't have heard about it, because obviously the world outside Spain was Jew. But he banned Freemasonry. He gave them you'd get a 10-year sentence if you were caught as a Freemason, which tells me that he certainly knew the situation. Jews would not have been favourable in his eyes, I don't believe.
Well, yeah, that says a lot, doesn't it?
He persecuted the communists. He's banned Freemasonry. Doesn't leave much to the imagination, does it?
Well, yeah, that pretty much prevents the Jews from being able to operate, doesn't it? If you ban communism and you ban Freemasonry.
Yeah, so sometimes you can't find the exact proof you need, but everything leads you to that. Just like everything Hitler does leads me to tell people he's a Christian.
I mean, there must have been a lot of subversion. Now, the West must have tried to subvert Franco's regime for the 40 years that he was in there.
Yeah, well, not just Franco, it was all of Europe, weren't it? I keep saying to people, there was a lockdown in Europe where you only heard what they wanted you to hear. Remember, you know, Jews control the media. They shut down Germany for 5 years after World War II, destroyed all the textbooks, made them rewrite all the educational books, even changed the speeches in the books to make Hitler look the more aggressive. But people, because it's not just the lies what people are filled with, but it's what they're not told. If people are not told, then they don't know. They just look at it in 1945. Well, you know, the Germans should be fortunate we threw them some food anyway because we're starving, weren't they? That's the attitude. They didn't realise it was a prison for 5 years. And the Jews piled back into that country, took all the positions that Hitler had took off them, arrested anyone in a uniform, whether it be a soldier or a postman, and put them in prison. And not only did they put them in prison, put Jews in charge, and those Jews tortured them.
Horrific. Not like today, they would have been able to put a complete block out on information coming from there and also information within. So Germany wouldn't have known what was going on outside of Germany. The rest of the world wouldn't have known what was going on in Germany. And I guess the same with Spain. So we wouldn't have heard about the achievements that he made while he was in Spain.
Well, in the great story never told, I'm pretty sure you can remember at some point, Wagner's daughter, the composer's daughter, were talking, and she said they weren't even allowed to speak the name Adolf Hitler. You have to use a code.
USA.
So was it USA? Yeah, USA, yeah.
Yeah.
How bad must that have been? You know, you can't even speak his name. So, because what the punishment would have been, she didn't say, but you can imagine.
Imagine that. I mean, we can understand a little bit of what it's like today, can't we? We can't speak the truth. We can't speak the truth about race. We can't speak the truth about immigration.
Level, though, isn't it?
It's hate speech. But that's the same thing back then, isn't it? You can't talk about your recent history.
Time-tested.
Exactly. You didn't call it hate
the
speech.
The Jews do it every time. They always come with this anti-Semitism, and that stops people then dead in the tracks. So you can't talk, can't discuss, can't put in history books because it's against the law.
And yet, we're supposed to be the champions of free speech, or so we are told. We're told it's our free speech. That's what the Muslims don't like is our freedoms and our freedom of speech. And yet, our prisons
I'll
are
give an example.
Full of speech criminals.
In this debate I'm having on the internet at the moment, they mentioned some guy's got a page up on the internet criticizing the greatest story never told, and He goes through all the usual blather of trying to debunk it. And at one point, he claims that the book, Other Losses, which records the deaths of 1.5 million Germans after the war, is a fake. Basque is called, I think the author is not worthy of the name author. But the thing was that book was deep sixed. Call it Deep Six, which is military slang for books to be banned by the US government. And like you just said then, this kind of epitomizes they're supposed to be the advocates of free speech with the Second Amendment, First Amendment, all this, and yet they will ban books they don't want people to see, especially about American war crimes.
Especially about history, anything that contradicts the version of history that we're taught. It makes you wonder what they're going to be telling people about what's happened in the last 10, 20 years, what the history books are going to say about Afghanistan and about Iraq and about Syria and about Libya, and what they're going to be taught in schools. I mean, they're already teaching kids in schools how to teach kids about terrorism and what's behind terrorism. So that people don't say that it's Muslims, that it's Islam. They're already coming out with ways to brainwash the kids about what we see around us today. And a lot of people think that's a fairly new thing. But I mean, what you're showing is that this goes back 70 years, 80 years.
Tried and tested. Probably beyond then.
And we're just finding out these things now. I'd like to learn more about what life was like under Franco and what he managed to achieve. As I say, this is one of the first programs that I've actually seen that deals with it. Are you going to be looking into it any more in the series, Dennis?
Well, I don't think in a series, I don't think, but possibly, you know, I will look into it. I mean, I was amazed when I saw that funeral, the first person, because it looks like a funeral fit for a king. The first person I thought of, believing it, was Adolf Hitler. Never got it. He never had that at the end of his life.
Yeah, he should have done. Well, what's coming up next then? What's going to be in the next episode?
Well, it's difficult to say because I'll say something and I'll probably end up doing something completely different because this always tends to happen. But what I can say is I found some really disturbing news. It was news to me anyway. I'm pretty sure it had been news to a lot of people. How can I word this? Confirms my thoughts on Roosevelt and how he intended to always get in the war. I mean, I'm sure people, you know, from our side know that anyway, but a lot of people don't realize that Roosevelt couldn't get him into the war, had to do the false flag. But there's some news. What I heard the other day was fascinating. And when I compare it to a speech from Adolf Hitler, what I'd heard only the other week, and the thoughts what I had on when he was talking about when they went into Russia, he was giving a speech after 6 months, and he was saying to his audience, it's over. It's more or less over. Right. Now, I'm thinking to myself, obviously, looking back now in hindsight, he's thinking this war is over. Something drastic has happened to turn this because he doesn't get in front of the Reichstag and talk like this if he's not 100% confident, which I believe he was. But like I said, I found some information out which I'm going to look further into, obviously, but at some stage it's going to be included.
Well, we can look forward to that then, Dennis. So we're coming up near the end of the podcast now. I've just got a message here to send out. I've been asked to say there's the Daily Stormer Manchester Book Club that are hoping to have a meet-up soon. So anyone in the Manchester area or in the north of England, check out the Daily Stormer forums in the book club section. I think it's someone called Feathing Gaunt. It's under Manchester Book Club anyway. And I do apologise about these sound problems at the beginning of today's podcast. I'm really not sure what actually caused that, but it seemed to sort itself out at the end, and I've recorded it on three different bits of software, so I'll have to stitch it up together to or edit it together, splice it together, so that I can upload it for later. Dennis, thank you very much for coming on.
Pleasure.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We'll be back here same time, same place for more Truth Without Radio next week. We hope you all have a wonderful weekend ahead of you.